This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachel. The women's ACC basketball tournament is underway in Greensboro this week. Three North Carolina teams still left, Wake Forest, NC State, and Duke. Years of dedication from young female athletes culminate in tournaments like this. Attendance at women's NCAA tournaments has steadily increased over the years, but the men still eclipse women in crowd size. Joining me to look back on the history of women's basketball in North Carolina is Pamela Grundy. She's a historian and author of the book Shattering the Glass, The Remarkable History of Women's Basketball. Pamela, welcome to State of Things.
Glad to be here, Frank.
In your book, you say that women's basketball, the history of women's basketball, closely follows the history of women's movements. Talk more about that.
Well, I think sports in the U.S. is really seen as closely connected to the economic and political realms. And so as women have sought to gain greater roles in those realms, they've also sought to gain greater roles in sports. And when conditions have been right for that, they've been conducive to sports as well as to things like voting and jobs and those sorts of things.
So talk about the trajectory. What have we seen? Because in basketball in particular, women entered the field of basketball much quicker than they did in other sports, did they?
Well, yeah, women started basketball right after it was invented. It was seen as a suitable game for women. It was designed to be more sedate. It was it played indoors. And so they start playing it right away. And basketball isn't that big a deal for men. It's kind of seen as a sissy sport compared to football. So women get started in it. And particularly then in the 1920s, as the high school spread throughout the state of North Carolina, a lot more young high school women get involved. There's not a lot at the college level, but high school women get involved. And then as the textile industry grows and they start having industrial teams, then you get a lot of great women's textile teams. Of course, this is a place where women are working in the textile mills, so it makes sense that they would be on the teams as well. And so there are some just great textile teams, a great basketball culture that grows up, particularly in rural and working class communities and also in African American communities, where again, women are given a little more leeway to be part of the public realm.
Now, things slowed down a little bit for women, or at least some women in the 1950s. Is that right?
It slowed down enormously. At the end of World War II, people come back, you know, troops come back, and there's a real conservatism that sets in across the country. This isn't just in North Carolina. Women are seen as, in popular culture, in middle-class culture, pushed back into the kitchen. They're supposed to be at home taking care of the kids. And as they're pushed out of those roles, they also get pushed out of sports such as basketball. And there's another specific thing. It's particularly bad in North Carolina because men's basketball starts to become such a big deal, college men's basketball. And as college men's basketball becomes more important in North Carolina, high school boys' basketball becomes more important, and they start to take greater priority over high school girls' basketball.
Then along comes Title IX. Talk about the impact.
Well, Title IX, of course, one of the things, it takes a long time to have an impact, just saying, well, women should have equal opportunity. What does that mean? But over time, bit by bit, there are some traditions left. Kay Yao at NC State is a great example. She's someone who had played in one of these rural communities, and so she's able to get it at NC State and really build up on her experience. And so slowly, there starts to be support for it. Schools start spending more basically because they have to, and you start building up a new women's culture.
All right, so let's go back again, because you talked about those earliest days when it was fine for women to play and really the sport kind of grew. Who played on those early teams in North Carolina?
Well, the first teams were at women's colleges, and those usually played intramural sports. They didn't really play publicly, but the first real community teams were these high school teams. And again, particularly in rural areas, in textile communities, and in African American communities, these are young high school women, and they want to get out there, particularly again, the 20s. Women get the right to vote in 1920. And so, you know, there's this real enthusiasm. They want to get out there and play and be seen and be recognized for their abilities.
It's interesting, too. You said early, maybe in the 30s and 40s, white high schools didn't have basketball teams, but African-American rural teams were some of the best in that period.
Well, they did. White high schools in the cities didn't have teams. White high schools that served textile communities, rural high schools, they had. It was sort of the middle-class city sort of lady ideal that those were the women who didn't play competitively. But there was this whole other range. And in African-Americans, in fact, even the black colleges, although they do have the idea of what a lady is, they also have these fabulous teams because they have a broader concept in the African-American community over what women need to do and what women are capable of doing. So you have Bennett College, which turns out the Bennett Bells, the great ladies of North Carolina, also has a fantastic competitive basketball team in the 30s.
So tell us more about then the impact of socioeconomic class in the development of women's basketball.
Well, again, I think it's more that the middle-class women subscribe to this ideology that women are supposed to be very different from men. They're supposed to be more moral. They're supposed to be protected in the home, in the private realm. And so then that really bleeds over into that women should only play intramural sports. They shouldn't be too rough. They wouldn't, you know, they might get hurt, those kinds of things. Whereas you get these rural communities, you get these textile communities, women work in the textile mills. No one worries the same way about women getting hurt. Same with African-American communities. You know, African-American women had always worked. So there's not this need to, there's not this same restrictive idea of what a lady should be that you get in these middle-class white, often urban communities. Of course, the challenge is that these are also the communities that govern, you know, state popular culture, you know, mass culture, that govern the state. And so they can have a pretty big impact. In the early 50s, in fact, there's a high school girls state tournament started for the first time, run by some of these rural communities, and the powers that be from the state, the people who are promoting this more ladylike way of sports, they squash it. They actually get it banned.
Well, what about these days? We'd like to think we have some different ideas. Ideas have evolved and progressed a little bit about how we understand women, but certainly women are still not paid the same and they don't receive the same attention. What do you think is going on now?
Well, I think there's an understanding that women can play sports and that women should be allowed to play sports. But it doesn't produce the same level of enthusiasm broadly that men playing sports do. It's still kind of a niche thing. And so you don't get, as you noted, the crowds are growing. People are learning to appreciate it, but they're not what the men's crowds are. You know, people don't get as excited on a broad sense seeing women play. And so they really haven't overcome this idea that it should be as fantastic to watch a woman play as to watch a man play. That's just not part of our culture, and that or lots of our culture. And that's very deep-seated, again, in the sense of what should men be doing? What should women be doing? What about men is admirable? What about women is admirable?
Well, I want to bring somebody into the conversation who was quite fantastic to watch to play, who is a fantastic player herself, Chasity Melvin, 2001 WNBA All-Star, a North Carolina Sports Hall of Famer, and alum of NC State Women's Basketball, and currently the assistant coach for Loyola University Maryland's women's basketball team. Chasity, welcome.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Thank you guys for having me. I really appreciate it.
And Pamela Grundy is still with us, historian, author of Shattering the Glass, The Remarkable History of Women's Basketball. Chasity, you grew up in Roseboro. How did your family, because I know you had a passion for basketball, how did your family feel about this passion that you had for wanting to play that game?
Well, I grew up in a rural town, and I was tall, so my fourth grade teacher asked me to play basketball in fourth grade, an intramural game. And I said, I don't know anything about basketball. And she said, it's okay, just come, you're tall. So I came and I made my first basket, and I fell in love with it. I was hooked. Yeah, I made that
stand,
first
just come here, stand here, is that it?
Yeah, just stand there in the middle, you're tall. And so after I made that first basket, that was all she wrote. I went home and I told my mother that day, and I have two brothers and two sisters, so we were always telling her something we wanted to be. And I said, I want to be a professional basketball player.
Wow.
And she started laughing, and she said, baby, they don't have professional women's basketball teams. And I said, well, you know what, Mom? They're going to have one by the time I grow up. And that was it. That was the end of the story. And I never let it go. But it became a challenge at home playing because my mother, it wasn't a girl sport. My mother, I mean, it was the rural town. I was supposed to play with the girls. We were supposed to be in there learning how to cook. I didn't really do that. And so what happened was, I went outside to play with my cousins because they were always playing basketball. They wouldn't let me play, my boy cousins. So I went to my grandmother, who was like the hierarchy in our small town, and I said, they won't let me play. So she went out there and she said, son, does everyone eat around here? And everybody was like, yes. And she was like, okay, well, if Chastity can't play, then everyone won't eat, just Chastity will eat. And then I had no more problems getting on the court after that.
Come on. Oh, that's good. How did you do then? I mean, because now they're forced to play. There's a girl playing with us, right? How did that all work out? And did they eventually accept you? I mean, talk a little bit about what that dynamic was once you're in the mix.
Well, they just I had to learn how to play. Yeah, just like everyone else that stepped on the court. I mean, you just don't automatically know how to play. And then once they realized I had a little bit of talent and I could actually score. I mean, once you can score the basketball when you step on the court, everything else just kind of pans itself out.
Hey, tell us about, I know you played for NC State and you played for the late coach Kay Yao. What did you learn from her?
I learned everything. I learned how to be not only the best basketball player, but a great person on and off the court. I learned great qualities to be a great leader. I learned how to motivate myself, become self-motivated, to chase my goals and dreams. I learned etiquette as a female athlete, coming from a rural town. Coach Al, it's funny, Coach Al used to always, you know, teach us how to be a lady because that was the Southern thing. So she wanted us to be respected on all levels. I learned a lot from her.
Now, you talked about growing up wanting to play professionally. Your mother points out, perhaps somewhat unkindly, that there is no professional women's basketball. There was by the time you left college, but I guess when you entered college, there still was no professional basketball. Am I right?
There was still no professional basketball, except overseas. Yeah. And USA Basketball, of course, you know, I had a dream of playing, okay, well, Mom, I could play for USA Basketball. I have a chance to get a gold medal. So I had that aspiration as well. But I just kind of held on to it. My dad was a minister, so I grew up learning a lot about, you know, asking God, praying to God, people call it now putting stuff in the universe, manifestation. So I took all that from, like, being in the church under my father and just listening to, you know, write the vision, make it plain, and I just kind of stuck with it. So I used my nativity, I guess, just from church and everything else. Like, I willed it into existence for myself.
Oh, ignorance is one of the greatest tools in the world, is it not? When you don't know why you can't do it, then the world is your oyster. You were drafted. There was an ABL by the time you left college. Talk about that and the decision to play in the ABL.
My decision solely to play in the ABL was because I didn't want to go overseas. I had an opportunity to play at home, and I wanted to be around my family. I wanted to see all my fans, and I wanted my fans and my parents and everyone to see me play. So that's a big reason why I chose the ABL. And at the time, the ABL had the most gifted female professional players. And as a competitor, I wanted to play against the best.
And so forgive me, what I didn't point out was that the WNBA had also started by then, and you could have gone either way. Right.
Yeah, I could have gone either way, but still a lot of the best players that I looked up to and I wanted to compete against were still in the ABL.
Yeah.
So I chose the ABL. And I wanted to stay in the States and play the full season during the regular basketball season like everyone else plays.
Well, they folded, and I want to talk about what happened next with you. But, Pamela, let me ask you about the development. Why were these, I mean, we'd gone for this long without professional women's basketball. What was it that prompted anybody to think now's the time?
Well, I think the women's college game had been growing, and you had all these great players who wanted to be able to do more. And at the same time, you do get the WNBA, the NBA is interested in expanding their audience, looking for ways to bring in new fans. And so that was a period where there was a moment where women's basketball was really riding a high. There'd been actually earlier effort to do professional basketball that had failed a few years earlier, but it just seemed like it was the time to really go for it. And so you got not one, but in fact two leagues trying to give women these greater opportunities and create a different kind of market.
And give us an insight into what was happening, Chastity, because you were playing for the Cleveland Rocker, right, of the ABL. And talk about sort of how and why they folded and what you did next.
Well, the Cleveland Rockers was actually the WNBA. I got drafted after the ABL folded. And actually, I got drafted by the Philadelphia Rage. I was the second pick. And I was under the Hall of Famer, Ann Donovan, who just passed away a couple of years ago, rest in peace, who was a great Olympian, great player and coach, but played for ODU and bought championships for their team. So I went to Philadelphia Rage, and I also had the opportunity to play with the great Teresa Edwards, who was also the GOAT. And just we couldn't get any sponsorships. We couldn't get any TV time, and that's what really hurt the league. And when the WNBA started, they kind of, you know, they had the big NBA, they had sponsorships behind it, and we kind of folded. And I was depressed. You know, I just kind of graduated from college. I got my first job, my dream job. People go to college to get their dream job. And so I acquired my dream job, and then I lost it. So a lot of us were depressed. And then fortunately for me, I had an agent who got me a gig overseas in Vigo, Spain. And so then I ended up having to go play professional overseas, and my mom didn't really like that much. But I had to do what I had to do to play the game I loved.
And came back to the WNBA and were an All-Star in 2001, clearly a skilled player. But there's still a pay gap. Was that any part of your thinking at the time? How did you feel about that?
All the pioneers of the WNBA and the ABL, same, you know, we felt like we just had to put a great product out there. For me, I was a basketball junkie, so I understood how the NBA had come about. I watched the NBA with my dad and my brothers. So they weren't getting paid either. They didn't have fully guaranteed contracts. A lot of the guys played injured. When they got injured, they got cut. So there was a lot of nastiness going on in that business as well when the NBA first started. It wasn't always the NBA as we know it today. So for me, I knew the history of the NBA game, and that's what I was kind of like following along for the path of the WNBA. Like, we got to make this thing work. We have to put a good product. We have to brand ourselves well. And we have to get fans and get support. So for me, I didn't really look at the money issue as something terrible. Like, I looked at it as like, okay, we got to build this up. And as you see with the new WNBA collective bargaining agreement, it came a lot later than earlier. But, you know, there's a change. I'll say this. It's a positive change into the right direction.
Well, and you're coaching now and eventually started a coaching career after going through the NBA coaching program. You were the first female coach hired by the Charlotte Hornets organization and coach for the Greensboro Swarm. So talk about that experience.
That was an unbelievable experience for me. Like I told my mother, you know, I always told her I can't dream big enough. And for me, I didn't have a dream of coaching men or coaching in the NBA because I just never saw it as a reality. And I was okay. Like, I just wanted to coach, and I felt like coaching women's basketball was just as successful. I would just be as successful as coaching men. And I didn't see women in those roles as head coaches coaching men or even as assistant coaches. So for me, as you get older, I didn't have the same naivety as I did as an 11-year-old. But I got in the program, and I worked my butt off, and I had an opportunity to interview with the Greensboro Swarm. And, you know, I knocked the interview out, and I got the position. And it actually was more like an internship, so it wasn't even actual assistant coach's position. I was an assistant coach, but I was housed through the NBA. And I learned a lot, and I felt, for me, I just feel like, hey, I can coach this game. And the game isn't any different. That was the funny thing to me. I had so many expectations, like, oh, my God, these are the men. They're playing. And subconsciously, you know, you don't really realize it, but it's like, okay, men's basketball has to be better. It has to be harder. It has to be more difficult. Although I had played pro for almost 14 years, I still had that mindset. So when I coached the NBA, I'm like, oh, it's basketball. You know? I just like relax. Like, I'm not saying it's not challenging. Coaching is challenging in general on any level. But it just hit me. Like, every day I kept coming to say, like, it's got to be different than women's professional basketball. And it wasn't. It's just basketball on the highest level. And it really got my competitive juices going because it was so much faster. So my decision-making had to be a lot quicker. That was probably the most challenging quality for me.
Chasity Melvin and North Carolina Sports Hall of Famer, WNBA All-Star Assistant Coach for Loyola Maryland Women's Basketball Team. Chasity, thanks so much.
No worries. Thanks for having me.
Pamela Grundy, historian and author of the book Shattering Glass, The Remarkable History of Women's Basketball. Pamela, thank you.
Thank you. And I also want to mention quickly my co-author Susan Shackelford, so there's two of us. But thank you so much. It's great to have you supporting women's basketball like this.
And you can find links to the book at our website, stateofthings.org.